Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Lisa C., whose latest novel is Shanghai Girls. Earlier novels, Peony in Love, Snowflower and the Secret Fan. There are six novels and one nonfiction memoir. There's also a short story that appears in a collection of short stories by people who are mixed race. Before we get into Shanghai Girls, how did that come about? You were not the editor, but they asked you to contribute?
Right, and they actually weren't short stories. They're just essays from people who come from biracial, bicultural families. And I loved writing that piece. They just called and asked, would I, you know, add one to it? And that was many, many years ago. That was sort of at the forefront of people thinking about those issues of biracial, bicultural. What I love about those pieces is that they're all very unique to the individual culture, but there are certain strands that come through that are, you know, similar, kind of universal experience.
It puts you in the position of not being one or the other, or understanding your heritage and other people just simply never seeing that heritage. Mm-hmm. I would not know that you were Chinese.
From looking at me.
Right.
The people who are listening can't see me, so I have red hair and freckles. No. So I get that all the time. You know, why do you write about China? What's your connection to China or Chinese American experience? And so then I have to talk about my family and my background.
Do you find it difficult sometimes having to explain yourself like that?
No. You know why? Because I really love the way I grew up, that part of it, that part of my childhood and spending all of that time in Chinatown with my great aunts and uncles and my grandparents. My mom was a single mother. My parents were divorced when I was 3, and by the time I was 10, we'd already moved, I think, about 9 times. I don't even know how many elementary schools I went to. And so Chinatown and the Chinese part of my family, that was like home base for me. That was the place that didn't change. For me, then, to go back and talk about what that meant to me and how it formed me and how my identity sort of, I think, like anyone, you know, it's the people you see around you. They're your mirror. I may look like this, but I have about 400 relatives in Los Angeles. There are about a dozen that look like me. The majority are still full Chinese and then this spectrum in between. So that's what I knew. And again, that's what really nurtured me and made me who I am. So I really like to talk about it because it takes me back to that time and place.
In many ways, Shanghai Girls, your new novel, does the same thing. It's not in any way, shape, or form autobiographical, except in a kind of tertiary sense, mm-hmm. maybe. But it is biographical about your family. There are key elements that are your family's history.
Sort of. There are two sisters who come to Los Angeles in arranged marriages. Well, we had a lot of arranged marriages in my family.
When you're talking about the arranged marriages in China and then the people came over, okay, mm-hmm. you knew as you were growing up these people in arranged marriages.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. How did they feel about marriage? How did they feel about romantic marriage? Did they have a different view?
There wasn't much in the way of romantic marriage. That really was not part of it.
But there was in America, and they were in L.A.
Right. And actually, because of the time that they married. So let me just give an example. So my great uncle, back in 1932, he took his family back to China because it was the Depression. It was cheaper to have your family take them across the ocean, feed them, house them in China than it was to take care of them here during that really those worst years of the Depression. He decided, you know, as long as they were in China, let's just get all you boys wives, you know, and so they had arranged marriages for all the boys. The oldest one was about 25. The youngest one was like 15 or 16. And these young women who in China, at a time when things were really evolving and changing, and these were not like their mothers. They didn't have bound feet. They were educated. They even expected to marry, many of them, for love and not to be in arranged marriages. And they thought they were marrying sort of wealthy American, you know, gold mountain men. When they got here, it was a very different situation. They had had servants in China. They became like servants here. And they lived very closed in, very narrow lives. In China, things were evolving and changing across the board, but for women. But in American Chinatowns, you know, you couldn't live outside of Chinatown. You couldn't marry outside of Chinatown. You couldn't work outside or go to school outside. So those early families that came, the kind of pioneer families, they hung on to traditions and to culture really strongly. Time had stood still. China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, things were changing, but not in American Chinatown. So these women were like thrown back in time 50, 100 years. They didn't go out of the house, my aunties. You know, the only times they went out were for weddings, funerals, and one-month birthday parties. That was it. And it wasn't until their husbands died. Finally, they would get to go out. That idea of romantic love, you know, some of them, I think, did sort of develop that with their husbands. Some of them just, it was like, okay, here I am with this man. And had no connection. I mean, they had children, they had families, but it was not even remotely romantic or even particularly loving. Very, very sad, actually, for them.
Lisa C., Shanghai Girls, from what I know of your earlier and what I've read of your earlier books, it almost seems like a book that you were, in a way, destined to write, because it deals with the generation of women, two generations before you, and their changes in America, and almost seems like a fictional mirror image in some respects of On Gold Mountain, but of course with the voice of the woman.
I think the difference between fiction and nonfiction, with the nonfiction, I was really stuck with exactly what happened to my family, you know, exactly, and all of those historical dates and exactly what happened. But with fiction, I could explore some of the issues about immigration, about arranged marriages, about the Chinese in Hollywood, and what's Chinese and what's American, what do you leave behind, what do you keep. And you can do that with fiction and with fictional characters in a way that you can't necessarily do with actual living people.
Shanghai Girls opens in 1937 in Shanghai, the city of Shanghai. Two sisters, beautiful sisters, have photos taken. They're put into these beautiful girl calendars. Now, you've collected these calendars?
Mm-hmm. I have. I've been collecting them for about, I don't know, about 15 years, and I love them.
Did you originally see them in the antique store of your grandfather?
I didn't see them there. They had in the family store in the workshop sort of more kind of 50s, 60s, Chinese calendars where they were, you know, young Chinese-American women with a bouquet of roses or holding their Coca-Cola bottle. They're pin-up looking, whereas the Shanghai poster art, calendar art, doesn't really have that pin-up look. It's really illustrating this very lush, to me, extraordinarily beautiful life and way of living. And the whole purpose of those calendars, the Shanghai calendars as opposed to selling Coke or face cream here, was to sell this modern Chinese woman, this woman who's completely different. She's the kind of person who plays tennis and golf and goes in airplanes and might even drive her own car and smokes cigarettes.
The research you did, I know you love doing research, and there's a tremendous amount of this, and that included the story of the Paper Sons, the Exclusion Act of 1882, which allowed for the Paper Sons, because people mm-hmm. could say they were born in America mm-hmm. when they actually weren't, as well as what happened on Angel Island and the Strange Confession Program, which reminded me a lot of McCarthyism.
Well, that's what it was. It was just one aspect of that fear of communism era.
Well, let's start at the beginning. When did you first hear about Paper Sons?
I knew about them my whole life because there were people in our family that you would say, you know, we're actually Fongs. So so-and-so's a Fong, but actually he's an Eng, or actually he's a Tom, or actually he's a Wong. And all the families that we knew had people in what seemed to be their families who weren't their actual uncles or brothers. These were people who had been brought over as paper sons. And some families, you know, it was very open, and in other families it was just never talked about at all.
Pearl, the protagonist of Shanghai Girls, finds out fairly late that her husband is a paper son. Mm-hmm. He never tells her. Was that common too?
That was very common. In fact, about 2 years ago, I get a lot of email from people through my website. And there was a young man who was writing to me and, you know, write back and forth. And he started writing about how his grandparents didn't treat him and his father in the same way that they treated the other children and grandchildren. You know, he was writing this. It was very sad. And so one day I just kind of wrote back lightly, actually, do you think your father could have been a paper son? And a few days later, he came to an event. He was just drained of color. He was just in shock, really, because he'd asked. And it turned out that, in fact, yes, his father had come as a paper son. And that all of the people that he thought were his family, his grandparents, his aunts and uncles, his cousins, all of these people weren't related to him at all, and he was just devastated by it. But here it is, 50 years later, that they'd been keeping this secret in the family down through multiple generations.
And I understand people are still afraid of coming forward because they think they might be, mm-hmm. after 50 years, they might be deported.
Right. When I was working on Gold Mountain, and that's 15 or so years ago, there were some people who wouldn't talk to me. And that was the reason. They said, you know, what if they send me back? There was a guy I interviewed who had participated in the confession program. And that was in 1957. And he and his brother had stepped forward together to say, yes, we came as paper sons. They had gotten their citizenship as a result. What the confession program had asked was for people to step forward, confess that you came here illegally as a paper son, claiming this false citizenship, and that if you did that, you would be given your legitimate citizenship. It was a kind of an amnesty program. But, you know, it was the government, so it had some fine print in there, which was, it's not enough just to confess about yourself. You need to also rat out your friends, your family, your business associates, your neighbors. And better yet, if you could say, oh, and by the way, so-and-so's a communist, for sure you would get your citizenship. Anyway, these two brothers came forward together. They didn't have any of that extra stuff that they had to do. They got their citizenship. That was that. It was really easy. But here, 50 years later, when I interviewed him, and he's in his 80s, he said, we've never told our children, we've never told our grandchildren, because we aren't dead yet, so we aren't safe yet.
Lisa C., before we went on the air, you said, and you said you thought it sounded a little strange, that the voice of Pearl kind of came to you. How did that happen? Well, I mean, what were the circumstances that you suddenly knew that Pearl was there and that this was the book to write?
Well, I actually started writing the book in the third person in the past tense. And as I was writing, I kept writing, and it was supposed to be third person, past tense. But as I was writing, by the end of every day, I'd be in the first person in the present tense. And no matter what I did, I just kept trying to fight it. And then there came a day where it was just like, okay, this voice is much more powerful and stronger than the voice or the way that I'm thinking. And so I just went back to page one and put it all in Pearl's voice. And from then, it just flowed so easily because she was in my mind and really speaking to me. And she had a way she wanted to tell the story that was not what I had originally intended.
There are a lot of things that she misses. She simply doesn't see. By her not seeing it, we as the reader may or may not see it, which is really cool because we kind of have to find our way in. Her voice is telling you things and you see more than her voice sees.
She's, I think, a classic case of an unreliable narrator. You know, that's a real tradition. But there are places along the way where you do get hints. I mean, and some of them are pretty big, that things may not be the way that Pearl imagines or sees them to be. I'm thinking of on the night after China City has opened, and Pearl and May are walking back to the apartment. And Pearl is pretty upset because she feels that things have been kept a secret from her. But when her sister starts saying to her, look, you know, I've tried everything I could to get you to leave the apartment, to get you to cross the street, and you wouldn't do it. So it wasn't so much that May was keeping a secret from Pearl, it was that Pearl wouldn't venture forward and didn't want to know.
The point where it really hit me was after they escaped from Shanghai and Pearl is raped and left unconscious and she wakes up in a hospital. And how did she get there? And never once does she acknowledge except kind of matter-of-factly, that May went through hell to get her there.
Right. I don't know if readers will think, what was happening with May? How did she get Pearl to the boat and all of that? And I hope that they do. Well, now that they've heard this, maybe they will.
What's interesting is that's almost going on in the beginning, because you more than hint that the man in Shanghai that Pearl was in love with was probably having an affair with May. So from the beginning, if you keep your eyes open and reading the books, in essence, in Shanghai Girls, you're reading two different books. You're reading May's story and Pearl's story, but you only think you're reading Pearl's story.
Right. I hope that by the end, people aren't like, oh, like in a mystery. You know, in a mystery, when you get to the end and it's somebody you didn't ever imagine and there were no clues along the way. And I always feel as a reader that I've been cheated. I mean, I tried to sort of lay in clues along the way for what was actually happening. And, you know, I did write these mysteries in the past. And so I think that those mysteries have helped me as a writer write very different kinds of novels, but to sort of know how you lay in that stuff that really are clues to someone's character, to what might have really happened, to the emotional landscape.
It's, you know, occurring to me, because I notice that books like Shanghai Girls, these are not mysteries. And I'm just wondering, and certainly a lot of classic literature does the same thing. Even Dickens did it.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, I guess, any novel, to really work, has to be kind of a mystery.
Well, I think so. Because isn't that what life is anyway?
Lisa C., the characters Pearl and May start in Shanghai. And I know you went to Shanghai for research. You went to the places, I guess, where they grew up. Are they similar now to what they were?
Well, Shanghai, of course, has changed so much. So much of it has been torn down, but a lot of it has been preserved, especially in the sort of outlying areas. So Pearl and May live across Suzhou Creek in an area called Hongku. A lot of those houses are still there. You know, I went through them and looked at a lot of different ones. I just went to Shanghai to do research for the next book. I stayed in the French Concession in what had once been Pockmarked Du's house, and it's now been converted into this kind of small boutique hotel. There are these places that are still there that you can see, and you can, you know, make sure, I can make sure that the details are correct. You know, a lot of the original houses have had squatters in them, you know, up to 20 people living in these houses since 1949. One of the things that's happened is that people don't, you know, they don't want to move out. They got their place. But there's also this sort of lingering sense that somebody, the original owner, could come back, even all these years later. So it's still the original carpet, the original drapes, the original furniture, the original things in the, you know, in the kitchen, the original stove. First of all, it's not theirs, so why upgrade it? And it's not theirs, so why take care of it? But this house still belonged to somebody else, so you can't remove it anyway. So some of these places, and they call those people the squatters, nails, that you can't get them out. You know, that there are people now who want to reclaim their houses, but that typically now to reclaim a house in Shanghai, it costs about $4 million to buy the people out of the house.
These are people who the Chinese government for years knew were there, and
it was
cool for them to be there.
Absolutely.
So in essence, they weren't squatters. The houses had been nationalized.
Right, exactly. Someone just yesterday was telling me about going back to his family home, and that there were all these people, you know, total strangers who've been living in that house for 50 years, but they have never lived in this man's grandfather's room, because that belonged to this man. After all these years, his name was Wayne, he said, you know, I told him, okay, you can go ahead and use that room. You know, he's been dead for a long time. I'm never coming back. Go ahead and use it. But that sense that, yes, these houses do belong to other people, even though we've been living in them for 50 years.
They come to America, to Angel Island. This was the Ellis Island of the West. The main difference was that its main job was to keep Chinese people out.
Right. I mean, everyone who came in through the Pacific from whatever country did pass through Angel Island. But the purpose, the main purpose of Angel Island was to keep the Chinese out. And this had grown out of the Chinese Exclusion Act. which had barred the immigration of all Chinese immigrants except for four categories. They were looking for people who were coming in as fake merchants. They were looking for people who were coming in as paper sons. They were trying to block their wives and their children from entering the country. You know, we tend to look at Ellis Island as a kind of welcoming place overall. I mean, there were moments of humiliation. You had to go through the medical exam. You had to answer 20 standard questions. But at Angel Island, Chinese immigrants didn't have 20 questions to answer. They had anywhere from between 200 and 1,000 questions.
And what was the coaching book? These were real, I would
guess. Oh, the coaching book. So you've bought your piece of paper to claim that you're a paper son. And sometimes what you would also get is a coaching book, something that would tell you all of the facts about your new family that would agree with all of the things that had been said by the people who had come in from that village and that family already through Angel Islands. Because when you went through these hearings, they brought out old files of people who had come from your village, the person you were claiming was your actual father, your uncles, the policeman on the beat, the gravestone maker, you know, all of these people that they had files that they would bring out. And then as they were asking questions, you had to match the answers in those files. So the coaching book gave you some of those answers.
The absurdity, of course, is that we wouldn't know those answers. Why would they? I mean, if we're being honest, and in fact, both Pearl and May are honestly married to presumably Americans, but since they're arranged marriages, they wouldn't necessarily know anything about that family, yet
right.
They were supposed to.
Yes, that's right. I think some of the questions that they asked, and of course I have 500 pages of documents from Angel Island about my own family, the transcripts from hearings, photographs, boarding passes. What has always struck me in these questions is how impossible they would be for me to answer. Things like, how many steps from the street to my front door? How many trees in front of my house? How many trees in front of the house three doors down? How many, and this one always got me, how many windows in the house across the street? I have no idea. You know, so these questions were designed from the get-go to have people make mistakes. And so you were really trying to answer those questions based on someone who had come in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years earlier.
And this went on until when?
Closed right before World War II, before we entered World War II. And then after we did, the immigration station on Angel Island was converted to a camp for POWs from Germany and Italy and other countries.
It never regained its status after that.
No, it never reopened again after that.
There's a tremendous amount of research throughout the entire book. And in a second, we're going to get to L.A., which is where you live now. How do you figure out not what to keep in necessarily, but what to leave out? At what point do you realize that there's just TMI, too much information here?
I love to research. I mean, that really in some ways is my favorite part. And so I over-research, and in the first draft, I put in everything I know because, you know, I found it. I might as well use it. And then in the editing process, I start pulling stuff out, taking it out, because it is too much information. And the story has to be about the characters and the emotions. That's the story. That's a novel. So I pull all the stuff out. And what I hope is that even though I've pulled it out, that somehow there's like this foundation underneath that readers might not know all of the details because I took them out, but they'll know that if they asked me, I would. For example, the girls come over on a boat that was part of the Dollar Steamship line. And I don't know, one day I just started thinking, you know, I wonder if it was still running in 1937. It turns out they went out of business in 1937, the end of the Depression. They'd made it through, but they went out of business at the end of the year. But they did have a couple ships that were still, you know, the last few. And so I got the date of one ship from when it left Hong Kong and when it arrived at Angel Island. And so I knew that if the bombs had dropped in August, the Japanese bombs, I knew I wanted to have that scene in Shanghai, and then I had to get the girls from Shanghai to Hong Kong to that particular boat that I knew left on that particular day. So I found that, and then it turned out that that boat later was conscripted by the U.S. Navy in World War II and was sunk. all this information I found out about a boat, but really none of it is in there except the date that it leaves and in its name. But I know it's there, and so that's the kind of thing I do. It's a little crazy, I suppose, but I love that stuff. I really love it.
I can understand researching it, but what if you hadn't found the right boat?
Well, then I guess you can make up a boat. But to me, it's really important to be true to the historical details, if you're writing a historical novel.
Is there any point where you departed from that?
I'm sure there are places where I did.
Well, they come to L.A., and it turns out, I guess maybe a lot of people in L.A. know this, I certainly didn't, that there were actually four Chinatowns in L.A., New Chinatown, City Market Chinatown, Old Chinatown, and then for a very, very brief time, something called China City, kind of a Chinese Disneyland. Mm. It burned down twice, right?
Right. It burned down twice, but there was one remaining building after the second fire, and it was into that building that my grandparents and great-aunts and uncles moved our family store in about 1950. So as a girl, that's the place that I spent all this time, was in this kind of skeleton of China City.
Are there photos of China City?
There aren't very many.
Christine Sterling, she's a real person,
mm-hmm.
right?
Christine.
And she created this strange
right.
Disneylandish. Everybody had to go there in costume, and there were rickshaws.
The people who worked there had to work in costume. She also developed Alvera Street. With Alvera Street, she had wanted to create this authentic Mexican marketplace. You know, if you've been there, you know how authentic it is. Not too authentic, but it has a certain amount of charm. And so just practically across the street was where she started this, you know, what was supposed to be an authentic Chinese city.
Using movie sets from...
from the Good Earth. That's right. From the Good Earth, but also the Chinese junk cafe was built from the leftover sets from Bluebeard's Eighth Wife. There were other sets that were there and, you know, had become part of the ambiance.
You make May, the younger sister, the casting director of Chinese People in Hollywood. Did you find the real May in your
research? Well, there was Tom Gubbins, who's in the
book.
Who's
real.
Who was a real person. He was the kind of, I guess, agent. He had a company called the Asiatic Costume Company, and he would provide extras and costumes and props to movie. But there were also several women, actually at least three women, who over time became agents. So there was a pair of sisters, they're both dead now, Mary and Dill Louie. And there was another woman whose name I can't remember, but they, all of them, did this work where they would find extras to be in films. And this really hit its zenith during World War II when there were all of the sort of anti-Japanese movies, all the war movies, and they didn't have any Japanese to act because they were all in internment camps. And so they hired the Chinese to act as the Japanese soldiers, the Japanese captains and generals and the rest of it.
Lisa C., one of the subtexts, buried subtext in Shanghai Girls, concerns how America views China. There's that whole era of Red China. It seems as if suddenly this thing, this evil entity, came in, swooped down, and changed everything, and suddenly the Chinese people became little robots, and then suddenly they stopped.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm talking from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And yet that's not really what it was.
No, it wasn't. You're right that during the Cultural Revolution, that is its own time. And, you know, a lot of the things that Mao said, okay, we're not going to have any more religion, we're not going to have ancestor worship, we're not going to have filial piety. You can tell people not to do those things, but that doesn't mean that they don't. And so some of it was very underground, some of it people actually didn't do. But as China has opened up, as things have loosened, you see this sort of resurgence in all of the old traditions. Maybe not so much with filial piety, but with a lot of the other things. I was just in China doing some research, and I was there for the sweeping of the graves festival. And I was out in the countryside. You know, people were going to grave sites and making offerings to their ancestors and doing all of the things that people in China, Chinese around the world, have done for thousands of years.
How about the view toward women and baby girls?
Well, Mao said women hold up half the sky. and he meant it. And so in many ways, China was much more advanced than the rest of the world in terms of women's equality and women's rights. I mean, in 1949, whether you wanted to or not, you got out of the house and you worked in the fields or a factory, or you went to school and you became a doctor or whatever. So in that regard, they were much, much more advanced. But they have a limited amount of land. They have this vast population. They instituted the one-child policy, and people still want to have sons. And part of that goes back to the ancestor worship, that it's really only the sons, the first son, who can make the proper offerings to take care of the family in the afterworld. And if your belief is that the afterworld is really just an extension of real life, that you still have all the needs, wants, and desires. That means you need food and clothes and a place to live, and these days an iPod and a cell phone and a fun car to drive, that you still need that in the afterworld, and that the only person who can give it is your son, then you're going to want to have a son. But interestingly, it's now in the cities people prefer to have little girls. In the countryside, where people still are working really literally hand to mouth, it's so agricultural, you need that physical strength of a man over a girl. But in the cities, people, as I said, prefer to have girls, and it's for a lot of the reasons that people prefer to have girls here. They're cute. You get to buy them fun clothes. And the totally mistaken idea that girls are easy.
If any element of Maoism that was positive remains, it would be the liberation of women.
Oh, absolutely. Even though I'm not advocating working in the fields, because that was and still is a very, very, very hard life. But overall, I think it just was tremendous for women.
Well, there is also in Shanghai Girls class. These girls are middle to upper class. Mm-hmm. Or they're actually middle class. There is a clear distinction between a peasant girl, dark, with gnarly hands, and the delicate hands and delicate face of a city girl.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very clear, and they were treated differently at Angel Island.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, definitely at Angel Island and all along the way. But, you know, that's not unique to Chinese culture. You know, you even see that in African American culture. You know, how dark are you? How white are you? What does that give you in the rest of society and in terms of your status in the Latino culture as well? So, you know, this isn't something unique to the Chinese. It's still pretty pervasive.
Lisa C., the ending of the book is a cliffhanger. Does this mean that there's going to be a sequel? Are you working on a sequel
yes,
right now?
Yes, I am. You know, either I'm a really bad writer or I've done something that, you know, Pearl and May just weren't done with me yet. But I definitely am writing the sequel. I've done all of the research. I actually haven't started writing the book yet, but I know what's going to happen to follow Joy, the daughter, on her adventures.
Well, you say that as if when you finished the book, you thought you were done, and yet the book does end on a cliffhanger.
You know, in my mind, I thought the end is a beginning. You know, the two sisters at the beginning are sort of setting out on this voyage, that now the daughter is setting out on this voyage. I didn't see it quite so much as a cliffhanger. I just thought of it as a kind of a return to the beginning, and this sense of, you know, going back across the ocean to a new, what for Joy anyway, the daughter, would be a new country.
At my end, what I saw was a potential ending. I mean, if it ended the book and you were done with it, but it struck me that the story wasn't over and what happens to the characters was clearly not over.
Mm-hmm. In real life, it's very rare that everything gets tied up perfectly. And so, you know, I was happy with the end, but everyone seems to want a sequel, and it's true that, you know, they're talking to me. The characters are already telling me what they want to say and what they want to do.
Is it also going to be from Pearl's point of view again?
You know, I went back and forth about that, and I've decided it's going to be Pearl and Joy. And I don't know, maybe May is finally going to get a chance to say something.
Lisa C., your latest book, Shanghai Girls, tells the story of two girls who grew up in Shanghai in 1937, wind up coming to America as immigrants and living in Los Angeles. much as members of your family did with the stopover in Angel Island. Here in California, in November, we had Proposition 8 about gay marriage. And one of the stories is that the Chinese community voted in favor of Prop 8 and against gay marriage. In Los Angeles, what did you see? I know that the Yes on 8 people had some pretty vile ads in Chinese.
No, Chinese today, typically, you know, most immigrant Chinese families are Republican. So you've got that. And I think that that's actually true for a lot of immigrant groups, that first generation that first gets to vote, they tend to be Republican. And then it's their children and grandchildren who kind of become a little more liberal as time goes on.
How do you think the No on 8 people could have made better inroads? What could they have done that they didn't do?
There is, in that community, in the Chinese American community, still a lot of stigma against just being gay in general, let alone marriage. And you need someone to step forward and be the face. You know, you need someone, it's like with Magic Johnson and AIDS, you know, that really sort of changed how a lot of people felt about AIDS. Now, whether that's right or wrong, that doesn't matter. It's just to have that person that's sort of familiar and a spokesperson who you can relate to or who you admire. And so I think that there needed to be and needs to be someone in the Chinese American community who could do that and do it with some real legitimacy and real truth. But also, I think that there really was a valid argument or a point to be made about the miscegenation laws, and that could have, in my mind, been played up a little more and used a little bit to a better result.
You have an actual position in the Chinese community down there?
I'm a commissioner. I'm a city commissioner. I'm on the El Pueblo de Los Angeles Historic Commission. That's for the historic city center of which the original Chinatown was part of.
You have been a commissioner in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
How did the Chinese community, were they supportive? Did they see the connection between, say, the election of an African-American president and the fact that they're a different race in America as well?
You know, I don't know that. I haven't really seen the statistics for Los Angeles and how people voted. I know among the younger Chinese Americans, of course, they were so excited
Sure.
about Obama. But there is a lot of racism in the Chinese community, I mean, in China and in the Chinese American community. So I think it was sort of maybe 50-50 somewhere in there.
Racism from the Chinese toward blacks.
Yes.
How does that manifest, do you think?
How does it manifest? It manifests the way that all racism manifests, you know, that you don't treat someone properly when they come into your restaurant, that you might not help them in the way that you could if you have are running a dry cleaner. I mean, it's just how racism has always been.
As a Hapa, as a half Chinese, mm-hmm. are you treated any differently in the Chinese community?
Well, it depends on which one it is. So in Los Angeles, because my family's been there for so long, there are a lot of people who know me and know how I'm connected. Los Angeles Chinatown is going through such a huge transition. Most of the old families are gone. They've either died or moved away. And so the people who've come in, there are all these trendy art galleries, for one thing, because the rents are so cheap. But the Chinese who are there tend to be ethnic Chinese from Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, from Southeast Asia, you know, who are poor, don't have a lot of money, and this is their first stop. So they don't know who I am. They don't know that I have a connection. You know, if I'm in one of their stores, they just think, well, I'm just another tourist visiting.
Lisa C., Shanghai Girls, and all of your books revolve around a tremendous amount of research. How do you think that research changes you politically or personally, or does it?
Oh, it does. It completely does. There are things, for example, in Shanghai Girls that I think have parallels to today, that kind of racial profiling, targeting a particular group because of where they came from or what they look like. I mean, these are not things that are new to today. These are things that have been in this country from day one, and things that happened in my case, to Chinese Americans. And so when I look at those things, and I don't know what readers think, you know, but I sort of hope that along the way, as they're reading my books and they're reading about the past and this experience that the Chinese Americans went through when they came through Angel Island, when they went through the confession program, that they can maybe have just a little bit of thought about what does that mean for people who are of Middle Eastern descent today. What might this mean for people who are coming from some other country that, you know, in this particular moment we don't want?
It's almost as if the research itself kind of radicalizes you.
Oh, I think it does.
Is there anything along the way that you can point to that goes, you know, that one changed me, that particular piece of information that I didn't know before absolutely changed
me? I can tell you one thing that I did, which was going out to Angel Island. And as you know, Angel Island, the immigration station there had been closed for many, many years while they were doing this big renovation project and conservation project. And so I had called the foundation and asked, well, you know, could I go out there one time just with the work crews or something? Just let me go out there. And they did invite me to go on this sort of private tour. And it's one thing to read about your family going through a place like that, and it's one thing to look at the photographs. But to actually, even just being on the little ferry, I had this feeling of what it must have been like to sort of be nearing that place. And it's, you know, very lush. It doesn't look like China at all. You know, it has all of that native California vegetation that already you know you're in a different place. And then to go through the barracks, and on this tour they took us through the hospital, which hasn't been reopened yet, I had this feeling of my whole family, you know, of what it was like for them and how frightened but also optimistic they had been, must have been. And that, you know, we all, whether it's, and people have that experience at Ellis Island too, that sense that we all have someone in our families who was crazy enough, brave enough, dumb enough to leave their home country to come here, and we all share in that experience. I don't think we feel terribly connected to it, but that day I felt very, very connected to it.
You've been listening to an interview with Lisa See, whose latest novel is Shanghai Girls. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.